Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Capitol Record. I am thrilled today to have Dr. Michael Munger, who's the director of philosophy, politics, and economics, and a professor in the poli-sci and econ departments at the great Duke University. Great because, of course, of the heritage of Coach K and their fantastic college basketball program, but also great because Dr. Munger is doing fantastic work in the subject of free enterprise and the threat that crony capitalism represents to the cause of a market economy. I was turned on to Dr. Munger by a good friend of mine out here in Newport Beach, Will O'Neill, who is has been mayor of Newport, is an elected city councilman, and someone who takes seriously the dangers of cronyism. And Will, upon turning me on to Dr. Munger, did me a great favor because I found a kindred spirit who really is aligned on understanding intellectually and morally the dangers of cronyism. So I'm going to invite Dr. Munger on, and he and I are going to unpack what is going on, where we find crony capitalism, and what we need to do about it. So with that said, we'll welcome Dr. Munger to Capitol Record. So with that said, welcome to another episode of Capitol Record, and welcome our first-time guest, Dr. Michael Munger of Duke University and the author of this fantastic piece I referenced, The Road to Crony Capitalism. Michael, welcome to Capitol Record.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So you were referred to me by a very close friend of mine here in Newport Beach, who is our mayor pro tem in Newport Beach, Will O'Neill, fantastic up-and-coming elected official, very bright and thoughtful, one of the rare people in elected office that I think has a high regard for being thoughtful around political philosophy and civics and economics. But he attended an event, I believe it was with the Club for Growth in Washington, D.C., where he heard you speak, was introduced to your work. And so he referred you to me, and he knows that this topic of crony capitalism is near and dear to my heart. Because our thesis here at Capitol Record, and of course, National Review is known as a sort of conservative think tank. We like to consider ourselves the vessel of movement conservatism. And I believe crony capitalism is a bigger threat to capitalism than socialism. I believe the cause of so many young people saying that they like socialism, which I consider to be an entirely unlikable proposition, is really their tantrum against what they see as capitalism being cronyism. You've dedicated a lot of your academic work to this topic. Maybe give us kind of a high-level overview of your contribution to where crony capitalism comes from and its effects in our market economy.
I think the way that you set it up is exactly right. If you look at the history of the competition between market systems and socialist systems, it's not really a fair fight. Famously, George Will said that the Cold War is over and the University of Chicago won, because the idea of capitalism seems to have carried the field. And so I've written some about a lot of American politicians and students on the left say we should be socialist like Sweden or the countries of Northern Europe. But in fact, if you look at the Heritage Foundation or other rankings of freedom, the ability to start businesses, the regulatory burden that is placed on entrepreneurs, the countries of Northern Europe are just capitalist as all get out. They're completely capitalist countries. And the reason that they are, David, is they wanted to have a welfare state where they tried to solve problems of poverty and of other public problems. And the only way you can finance that is with capitalism, because that's the only way to produce wealth, is to unfetter the creative energies of lots of people. So capitalism wins over socialism. It's not even a fair fight. But somewhere around 5 years ago, I realized that, and the way that you put it is exactly right, I realized that a lot of students are confused about what the advantages of socialism are, but they're not confused about the problems of capitalism. And a lot of people on our side will define cronyism or pathologies of capitalism as, oh, well, that's not real capitalism. That's cronyism. It's something else. And what it struck me was that there is a tendency within capitalism itself to devolve into something very like cronyism, where you don't have competition. And in fact, endless since Adam Smith have talked about that. Now, so in a democracy, capitalism tends to devolve into cronyism. And the semantic defense, oh, well, that's not real capitalism, that doesn't matter if that's what capitalism becomes. So either there should always be a Star Wars reference. I don't know if you remember in Star Wars when this captain comes in and tells Grand Moff Tarkin, we've analyzed their attack, sir, and there is actually a problem. Should we abandon the Death Star? And of course, Grand Moff Tarkin says, abandon now in our moment of triumph? I think you overestimate their chances. Well, no, that's not right. They actually blew the heck out of the Death Star because there was a giant hole in it. There's a giant hole in capitalism, and that's cronyism. To the extent that businesses find it more profitable to invest, and I'm making air quotes, which makes for a great podcast, to invest in government help instead of better plant, better equipment, cheaper products, and better consumer service, if it's more profitable to get the government to help you, capitalism cannot survive. And that's the problem that we face, and that's the problem that we should acknowledge.
And so the acknowledgement of the problem, as is true of course, so many things in our lives, has to be the precondition to addressing the problem. You can't solve problems you don't acknowledge you have. And so for now, your working premise is that it is embedded in capitalism, in the notions of a market economy, to migrate to rent seeking.
A tendency, yes.
My question on the solution side is, do you believe this response to those of us who treat cronyism as the severe threat to free enterprise and to human flourishing and to a market economy, a free and virtuous society that I want, and that candidly I've decided to devote my adult and professional life to? I believe cronyism represents this threat, and I have been trained to believe that the remedy is to limit the size of the state so there is less opportunity for the state to partner with entrenched business interest. I don't say that under the pretense that it is comprehensive, but that as a first principle, low-hanging fruit in the cause of diminishing cronyism and enabling a better allocation of risk and reward in a market economy, that the first step is limiting the ability of the state to have favors to offer and whatnot. Is this different than where you're headed, or is it a part of it, but then perhaps you provide a bit more elaboration?
I'm a political science professor, and when someone says we should limit the state, I have two questions. Who's this we, and where is this state you're talking about? Because in fact, what we have is voters who are usually pretty poorly informed and mostly look to the government for handouts. And then there's no such thing as the state. What there are is people. So I've proposed something I immodestly call the Munger test, which is anytime someone says the state, take it out and put in Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah.
So if I say, I think the state should limit itself, take out the state, put in Nancy Pelosi. I think Nancy Pelosi should limit herself, her own powers to control the economy. Is there any chance she's going to do that? The incentives of politicians are to expand, not to contract their power. So given the electoral incentives, there's no way that the state is going to restrict itself. Now, if somehow we, and I don't know what that means, voters can get together and we could pass a constitution, or honestly, just get the constitution.
Well, you know, some of us think we did once.
Well, just get the constitution we had before 1933.
Okay.
So up until 1933, we sort of had a constitution that protected freedom of contract and limited the capacity of the state to interfere with things that were none of its damn business in the first place. Right. If we could get back to that, that's great. I just don't know how we do that. And so I have very little hope for limiting the power of the state in the first instance. I think there are two solutions that might work. One is we need to do more things like you and I are doing today, take seriously the criticism, but point out that the solution is not more state, it's less state. If we had voters who understood that if they vote for more state, they're actually voting for cronyism. If you vote for more state, you're always voting for more cronyism. So you just need to have less state. Now, that sounds hopeless. I want the state to do good things. Well, that's not what states do. What states do is interfere with other people and limit our rights. That's what states do. So we have to limit them. So if voters recognize that and voters voted for people like our mutual friend who understand this problem, then we have a shot. That's not hopeless. Influencing voters to say, let's try to move back in the direction of the Constitution before 1933, that is some hope. The second hope is to have a dynamic, constantly changing set of new industries and new corporate actors. Because early on, young corporations, they're working to compete on the level. They're actually trying to expand their market share, produce better products, and increase investment in plant and equipment. It's old companies that then say, you know, it's actually more profitable just to pay off lobbyists to get taxpayer money for free. So as long as we get enough new business, so the answer is voters are smart. We just have to empower them to be able to act on this and make sure that the regulatory restrictions on new industries are not so throttling that we end up with all old companies. Because if that happens, we're lost.
So there's a little bit of complexity that we invite into the discussion. One of the things I'll bring us back to later, and it's why I teed this up by mentioning my friend Mayor O'Neill, is I do want to get your take on how we distinguish between the cronyism of local government and the feds. I think for our purposes right now, we're really talking about crony capitalism in Washington, D.C., the ability of big companies to partner with the federal bureaucracy to empower their own interest and whatnot. I do believe a cronyism problem can exist locally too, and I want to get your take on those distinctions, but we'll come back to that because this issue of limiting the power of the state, now the state has the incentives to never be self-limiting. Nancy Pelosi's not going to cut off her own powers. My working thesis has been that the size of government is inversely proportionate to the responsibility of the populace, that the New Deal came about as we were more and more forfeiting, I would argue, a moral and spiritual and cultural, but frank, a civic responsibility towards self-government, all entirely predicted by founding fathers. And so that today it is not a election by election victory or even a policy victory, but there represents in front of us this idea, can we increase self-government enough to proportionally and inversely limit big government in the next 10, 20, 30 years? None of us think that way because we think off of election cycles and who the next strongman that'll be that will supposedly do something we like. Do you think I'm being too moralistic, too simplistic, or is there an argument to be made that the only solution to limiting the size of DC is to increasing the individual responsibility of families, individuals, things of that nature?
I think there is some hope for politicians who will understand that virtue for the entire system, making the entire system better off, involves them, like George Washington, walking away from power. I don't want to rule everything. I want to have people rule themselves. I think that corporate CEOs who believe in the virtue of capitalism, and by virtue, I mean literally virtue, the good moral qualities of capitalism, are capable of saying, you know, we probably could invest in more lobbyists and in more cronyism, but we're not going to do it because that would be wrong. And it may be that their stock price will be somewhat lower as a result, but they'll survive better and they'll actually do a better job paying off on stockholders' investment because they'll make more money for a longer period of time. So I think a return to the virtues of capitalism, and I'm not using that as a metaphor. I mean Aristotelian actual virtues, the things that motivated the founders to say we would like to try to achieve fame. And what they meant by fame was a good reputation, not you have a lot of Twitter followers. Right now, what we want is a lot of Twitter followers. So that's a mistake. So I think that we could go pretty far in that direction. The difficulty is that at the federal level, when the state starts to expand the set of things it promises to do for us, if it fails to do them, our answer is never, well, they were never should have done that damn thing in the first place. It's, well, we need to spend more money. And actually, Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America in 1830 talked about, he thought that individual associations and individual power were essential for any government to work. And he thought America had a good start on that, but democracy enfeebles that impulse. And the word he used, enfeebles, is really important. So if you and I see a school that's falling down, we probably think we should form a nonprofit, we should get together and try to help this school do a better job. Most people, when they walk by a school that's falling down, say, oh, the state should spend more money. Well, that's never the solution. That's why this school is falling down, that we have a public school system. But our impulse to do things as citizens, as sovereign individuals, has been enfeebled by the encroachment of democracy into almost every aspect of our lives. So that's what we have to take back, is that associational, voluntary, private impulse that Tocqueville found so exemplary about the U.S. And we've lost it.
One of the reasons that the cause of economic education is so important to me, including primarily to my friends on the right. I wrote a book last year called There's No Free Lunch, 250 Economic Truths, that the target audience, Michael, was really like-minded people that I don't think know why they believe in free enterprise. They just know intuitively that it works better, it's been better for prosperity, it seems to be a more efficient distributor of risk and reward and things like that. I think we need this foundational understanding because the society, whether it's moral or economic, you brought up two issues there. I think economically, people could say the state needs to throw more money at the falling school because they economically fail to understand where the state gets its money. So there's this sort of free lunch fallacy at play about the economics of it. It's always easy to believe that an infinite resource can be used to fix something. But once we sort of understand the lack of Santa Claus at play in the economy, it changes things. But then I also believe morally, our individual responsibility to fix a failing school, to elect a better school board, to get people together to maybe plan a charter school, a private school, all those things I just said are a lot of work. I happen to know in this example because I've done it when launching a private school. But it seems to me that we need to remedy that issue, both moral and economic formation that will enable us to think differently than a default position to the state as this sort of arbiter of what ails society.
Yes.
Is there a problem with crony capitalism that the people actually want it? And this is what I mean. You know, you hear the thing all the time about like 89% of Americans are furious with Congress, but most people are not furious with their own congressman or congresswoman. And there's sort of a disconnect around that reality. It seems to me that people say, I'm sick of cronyism. I can't believe the great ride that Bezos and Zuckerberg and Musk get and all these things. And then you say, God, well, man, Facebook, what do you think we should do? And they go, well, we need government limitations on this, or we need to stop that. So they invite a greater role of the state into the process. Look at the environmentalists with Exxon and Chevron. This has been my argument forever. And full disclosure, my company, we're very, very large shareholders of both Exxon and Chevron. But I believe Biden is the gift that keeps on giving to Chevron and Exxon because the ESG movement is not really hurting them. It's hurting smaller producers. And yet people will say, I'm anti-cronyism and I want restrictions that are actually going to help the big guy and hurt the little guy. Is this the real problem in the society that people don't, there's a sort of unintended consequence in their desires, or am I, again, being too simplistic?
No, I think you put your finger on the essential failure. We've already talked about one, and that is the failure to think of virtue, individual virtue and self-governance as a solution to social problems. That used to be taken for granted. We no longer talk about it. But we used to do a fairly good job of inculcating into students the explanation for why free market capitalism was a superior system. I think most people had some vague understanding because they had some experience with it. You know, maybe they had sold things, they'd had summer jobs. The students that I see at Duke are remarkable. They're very smart. They come from excellent families, and they're going to be great people in the world, I'm sure. But if you ask them for the market, the argument for capitalism, what's the argument for liberty in markets? They can't come close to giving you the argument for it. And that I'm not saying they have to agree with it, but before you can disagree with something, you have to understand the argument for it. And so I think that we think wealth, planning, organization all comes from the state. They actually think that when they go to Whole Foods to buy one of their $7 lattes, that all that stuff was delivered by magic overnight, or that someone commanded all of it to be delivered overnight. In fact, there are many different systems that we call by the name supply chain that are organized by people that are elaborating a system of division of labor. So I spend almost a month in my introduction to capitalism class just making sure they understand the basic argument about how markets work. Yeah. And that means that for the rest of their life, there's a bunch of stupid stuff that they're going to say, well, actually, that's not right. Now, they may not become capitalists themselves, but there's a limit to how stupid you can be if you actually understand the argument for markets.
Mm. Well, and I think you're exactly right that there is a decent job in American society at appreciating some of the rewards of markets, but not what markets are, how they work. I actually think that Hayek's basic point against central planning and the sort of general Austrian case for markets as humans acting really has to start with the notion that markets do not need to be imposed, that they just are. That if we said there's not going to be any regulation or rule here, there's not going to be a forced store or a transaction or production consumption, there's just going to be a couple of people that are going to get together, that what will result is a market, and understanding it at almost that kind of embryonic phase allows people to develop a sort of maturity in the way that markets unfold over time. But to your point, it seems that there is a tendency in markets unfolding for the very successful market actor to then look for, much like a quarterback who's really got great receivers and running backs around him, but if he can get a great offensive line to just enable him to have more time in the pocket, he's going to take it. And we can want to use the state as that offensive line to provide us a little room for more playmaking and more creative offense. What do you think are the ways? I brought up Exxon Chevron around energy regulation. That subject with ESG these days gets beaten to death, although I think it gets beaten to death for good reason. I think it's a big problem. We talk about big tech a lot, but what are the ways that you see cronyism becoming most nefarious today in ways that maybe most people don't even see? They assume it to be benign.
In the public choice part of political science where I work, there's a concept called rent seeking that is very important, I think, for people to understand. So a rent is a supernormal return. And LeBron James earns a supernormal return in the sense that he's the best basketball player, and so he makes a salary more than a normal basketball player would make. So normally, it's hard to make rents or supernormal returns in a competitive capitalist system because other people say, I'm going to enter this industry and I'm going to make the same product or a similar product, and it's hard to keep rents. The way to have an important rent is to get the state to protect it for you. And there's a number of ways that we can do that if you can get the state to make it more difficult for people to enter. So I think one of the most kind of unexpected examples, and I'm always surprised at how students have never thought of this before, but after 2007, 2008 and the financial crisis, we had a new regulatory regime, and it was passed by Senator Chris Dodd and House of Representatives member Barney Frank. So if you look at who received the most campaign contributions from Wall Street in the House and the Senate, it was Chris Dodd and Barney Frank. And so what they wrote was legislation that imposed a lot of regulatory and compliance barriers on firms. And that looks like, okay, we're regulating those bastards more, really going to fix this. Well, suppose that you're a very large company and you have a bunch of accountants and compliance officers already, and there's new regulation and you have to hire four more. Okay, I can live with that. Maybe I'd prefer not to do it, but I can live with that. Suppose that you are a new nimble finance company. And right now you don't have any compliance officers because in the absence of regulation, you can just pursue your main business, which is to create value for your customers in financial markets. But now you've got to hire four compliance officers. You've only got seven people in the office, and four of them are compliance officers. So cronyism can just take the form of imposing fixed compliance costs on all the firms because that dramatically benefits the existing large incumbents because it creates entry barriers. And once you start to think in those terms, it's like a licensing for someone that does eyebrow threading or state licensing for someone that does hair braiding. If you impose all of these additional fixed costs, the cost to consumers go up. And why? Well, it's because of this positive, favorable regulation. No, it's because of cronyism. So when you see these large firms benefiting from the very regulation that people on the left say we're using to control them, then I think you start to understand how pervasive cronyism is.
So you use two examples here. I want to approach both because I think they scratch different itches. The bottlenecking, as you refer to it in your article, and the notion of using sort of occupational licensure as a means of a barrier to entry is really more prevalent, it seems to me, in small business America. Yes. In a lot of ways, more insidious and just really kind of contemptible.
Yeah.
Hair braiders and things. And I will say, and I know they get demonized all the time, but it's something that I first learned about as a systemic problem from the Koch brothers, who would just send out armies of lawyers and activists to go defend, you know, small self-employed hair braiders in Louisiana and people like that that were
flower arrangers, people who own flower shops.
Just the silliest thing. And this is a case where, for the most part, we can win this argument emotionally because I'm just unaware of people who feel a strong passion for the cause of getting more regulation into flower arrangements and hair braiding.
Well, the flower arrangers do.
Nobody
will vote for it except the flower arrangers.
That's right. And that, of course, is your point. I get it. With the Dodd-Frank environment, I think that we all got sold a bill of goods, but it's understandable to me how we got sold it. Because other than the rent seeker flower arranger who's trying to push out Aunt Mabel from her kind of backyard business, nobody is out there worried about the systemic effects of flower arrangements. But with the big banks, Dodd-Frank told us we're here to protect the little guy from the big banks. And so then they went after credit card points and debit card fees and ATM and just this other chicken shit stuff that had nothing to do with the financial crisis.
But a lot of activity, a flurry of activity.
And it was almost unpopular to oppose it because they had branded it as therefore you were opposed to financial regulation. They used these terms, wild west capitalism and stuff like that. Now all I know is I read the 10Qs and 10Ks all the time. We're big shareholders of both JP Morgan and Truist. And we used to be big bank stockholders of a lot of community and small regional banks. And they have no way to make money. And they relied on these credit card points and these programs because it was a more competitive allure to their credit card program, where JP Morgan doesn't have a hard time signing up credit card customers. So in that sense, you use the term fixed compliance cost. And I think we have to understand that it is regressive, that what is a fixed cost to JP Morgan is very different than a fixed cost at mom and pop community bank. Was this a failure of our side to do public information, public education, or was the other side just really good in how they hoodwinked us with this crony Dodd-Frank?
I think it was a coalition of people who had naive, moralistic desire to just get more regulation of this evil industry, and cynical people who recognized that actually this benefited the big company. And that coalition was very difficult to fight. So I think that the thing that I have found most surprising is when I say, you know, Dodd-Frank is basically a terrible piece of regulation. They say, what would you do? Well, doing nothing would have been better than this, because right now there's no political representation of all the little banks and firms that don't exist. How do you understand all of the small firms that don't exist, that would be employing people, that would be looking for innovation, that would be making local loans because they have better and more local information? What you've done is you've wiped out a whole part of an ecosystem. And then I admit, it's hard to say, well, what should we have done instead? I do know that if we hadn't done this at all, and we had just imposed more regulation that prevented the state from bailing out the large losers, that's really the problem, is the ability that if a large company wins, they get to keep the money. If a large company loses, they get bailed out with taxpayer dollars.
Yeah, but in fairness, though, I think that the equity people got hammered. Okay, we always talk about how Wall Street was bailed out. That would be news to the equity holders at Citigroup, or the bondholders at Lehman Brothers, for that matter. But the bondholders of everybody the bondholders of everyone not named Lehman did get bailed out. And I always have wondered why the solution to too big to fail was to codify too big to fail, which is what Dodd-Frank did. When what we could have said is, okay, you guys can blame cast on financial crisis all you want. And I acknowledge we couldn't let the world economy fall apart. So we did a bunch of things, some good, some bad. But going forward, because Dodd-Frank was not meant to cure 08. It was meant to avoid another 08. So on a go forward, why not say, we're telling you right now, if you lend money in the financial system, you will have to take losses.
You said it better than I did. What, instead of codifying too big to fail, which is just so that they actually called it systemically important financial institutions, CFIs. Yep. But basically that was too big. And there's a list of things. Don't do this. Well, if I'm a big company, that's my laundry list to do today. I want to be a CFI. All you would have to do is say we cannot bail out companies. And that means that people are going to internalize that. So you said it better than I did. It's not like people made money from this. Financial sector got hammered, just hammered. But having the state say, we're going to bail you out because otherwise it's going to be the end of the world. And it is. It's because we codified what it means to be too big to fail, and basically said, don't do this, and drew a big red circle about it.
And it seems to me that the really smart rent seekers look at the unintended consequences. I don't think when they told the Wall Street banks, you can't do things with proprietary capital anymore, that it was to help Blackstone and KKR, but it sure as hell helped Blackstone and KKR, taking all the talent off the prop desks, moving them to hedge funds and private equity and whatnot, was a great boon of talent and capital opportunity at other sort of non-bank financial outfits. And so again, there was this sort of shifting of cronyist opportunity, all unnecessary to your point, because the state didn't have to do anything.
Right. So I want to get to the state and local point, which I think is important, but what you're saying, I think, is crucial and is often missed, because our willingness to interfere with financial markets means that we're going to get less entry. We're going to get a different configuration of firms than we would have had. And as a result, over time, we're going to end up with, well, the Federal Reserve said, we're going to buy corporate debt and we're going to pay money on deposits. And then we're going to increase the money supply in order to increase spending. Well, a lot of these companies were perfectly happy to get a guaranteed return by having interest paid on deposits. So you can't push on a string is the saying in monetary economics. And so we have created a lot of this cash overhang by having the Fed create an enormous increase in the money supply, but by doing it by buying corporate debt and then paying interest on deposits. So that's a kind of cronyism in the sense we're trying to preserve the system, not freeing the system to do what it's supposed to do in a capitalist economy.
Those examples are powerful and accurate. And there are things, you know, maybe even offline, you and I could talk someday about some of the things that really happened, again, in a lot of cases, unintentionally during the COVID
moment. Yeah, I agree.
Companies like Boeing, that you had Nikki Haley stepping off their board because they were about to ask for a huge equity infusion from the government, and by the Fed merely announcing that they were going to buy corporate debt, all of a sudden their cost of capital collapsed so much they never did take equity from the government. And so there's this sort of backdoor cronyism. But I think we have the greatest example in human history that might be larger than every other example you and I have touched on so far put together, and that's Fannie and Freddie. And yet, I still think Fannie and Freddie are popular. Now, people might think of the terms Fannie, Freddie, and think there was something ugly that happened in 08 and the taxpayers bailed out somebody somehow. But when you say you have a 2.45% borrowing rate on your five-year interest-only loan, all of a sudden they love it. And the government becoming the housing market, this maybe comes back to the virtue, self-government, but there is a vicious cycle here that I don't put the blame only on K Street or only on Wall Street. Main Street seems to want Fannie Freddie. How do we break this apart?
There you go. So the problem in a way is democracy. Yeah. Now, I'm not saying we should get rid of democracy, but the problem is democracy, which is why I said a while ago, we need better voters. Yeah. And I can only do it one at a time. You know, I go have coffee with someone, I can usually convince them. You're doing it at scale. And so that's what we need is more of an attempt to do this at scale. And by at scale, I don't mean ranting about how a bunch of liberals are bad people. Yeah. It's actually talking about the nuts and bolts economics and the reasons why, if you want this thing, the thing that you're doing won't lead you to it. These economic policies will not lead to the economic outcomes that you desire. So Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were saying, we don't like the racist financial system. And I think it's actually pretty hard to make the case that bankers were leaving money on the table by not making what would have been good loans. That would be surprising. It means they weren't greedy enough. But if your claim is that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were necessary to make a market in these packaged mortgage-backed securities, and then they keep making that market beyond the point where they actually are worth what they cost, given their risk profiles, pretty soon people are holding assets that have almost no value. And they actually created the vacuum that sucked all the value out of the system. It was created by the state. It was abetted by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac under pressure from members of Congress who were worried about racism in the financial system, and we have to make more loans, even to people who can't pay it back. What could go wrong?
We found out. I say that. Did we really find out? I mean,
no. No, because we still want Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. We did not.
Yeah, and with a couple of presidents of different political parties and different leadership in House and Senate, and now here we are, you know, 14 years later, and we still have it. And real serious attempts to go back. I'm not unrealistic. I don't think they could have shut the spigot off on day one. And I think there's a lot of international financial complexity, which was even part of the problem of the conservatorship. So much of the debt being held by Chinese and Saudi. Yes. And it's a mess.
The demand for this product was unlimited.
You have a return premium without a risk premium.
And it's dollar denominated, so it's everything they want.
What could go wrong? It is effectively backed by the good faith of the United States government, and you're getting a higher yield than the literal debt of the U.S. government. So that's called free money. And for those who don't believe there's a free lunch, we went through the experience of what it all looks like. So let me ask you this as we get ready to wrap up. When you talk about the solutions to this problem and greater virtue needed in the C-suite of people who refuse to become partnered with the government, people who don't look for the power of the state to block off healthy and organic competition in their industry. All of those things are very important. And I know there are some good actors out there who encourage healthy, robust competition. But fundamentally right now, what do you think is the greatest thing that we can see? When you say people are supporting policies that will invite more cronyism, what are the things we need to do and stop doing to move the needle here?
Well, one of the reasons that I enjoy working with the Club for Growth is that a lot of these are young Republican. It's sort of the triple A, and these are people who are going to be moving to the major leagues. And a lot of our younger politicians or newer politicians at the state and local level are looking for ideas and policies and explanations that are the common sense things that will appeal not just to conservative voters, but to voters who are tired of this system, the left and the right. I don't want to hear any more about the left or the right. I want to hear common sense solutions. So I think we need to do a better job of empowering local officials with these kinds of arguments, with creating materials, whether they're written or podcasts that you can share. A voter calls you up and says, I want to know more about this. Well, here's this 45-minute podcast. You can learn quite a bit from it. Here's these other materials. So we need to create an infrastructure that our elected officials can draw on. And we need our elected officials to stop doing the easy thing, which is just talk about people on the left are evil. For the most part, people on the left are not evil. They're trying to do what they think is the right thing. They're just mistaken about that. So if you want to cure poverty, socialism has never done that. There is no socialist country that has ever solved the problem of poverty. If you want to have individual freedom and widely shared prosperity, capitalism is the answer. It's the only system in town. And so one of the things that I think we need to remind people is we have a federal system. So we have a bunch of regulations at the national level. But if you devolve power to the states, the ability of a state to have bad tax policies or bad regulatory policies is limited because people can go somewhere else. And both New York and California are trying to find this out right now. How many citizens can we lose and still survive?
So you have California and New York finding out the hard way, but you have Florida and Tennessee and Texas and so forth learning the good way.
Yeah.
It cuts both ways.
And so the old argument for federalism is actually the new argument for federalism. That's the limit on the power of the state.
However, you said something, though, that invites a little hypothetical pushback. I want Texas to have more favorable tax and regulatory policies and compete with California and bring Elon Musk and technology companies into Austin. I like all of it. But what about a state giving, you know, the way Nevada bribed Elon Musk for Tesla business? Isn't that cronyism, Michael?
Of course it is. And federalism also allows that. So the criticism of the left that it allows a race to the bottom, that's also true. Yeah. So, you know, we can use bribery to get these large corporations. We can use taxpayer money, money from the corporations that are already in the state, and use it to bribe new companies so that their taxes are zero. That's absolutely cronyism also. But most big movements of corporations are not explained by that. Those are the headlines, and politicians are always going to have that. They want to have their picture taken with a pair of scissors in front of a cutting a ribbon in front of a bright, shiny object. We're not going to get rid of that. But by and large, North Carolina, Florida, Texas have grown because we have friendly regulatory environments, low tax rates, and an educated population. And so the old things that used to create growth still do. So I think if we can emphasize that for state and local officials, here's the reason. We're not cutting taxes to help rich people. We're cutting taxes to help poor people because it's going to cause growth and prosperity. And look, it's done it. We actually have a record of achievement. So I think that's the way that we can win by focusing on the states.
And it also seems to me, I don't know how you felt on that Amazon issue when they were doing their beauty contest a few years ago, but it infuriated me that AOC was making an argument that I agreed with and that no one on the right.
She was absolutely right. A stop clock is right twice a day. She was absolutely right.
But I think that if we say, no, we want to support business, it creates jobs, blah, blah, blah. All we have to say is, of course, so we can have an environment that will make that will attract jobs for all people, not just Amazon. Why limit the economic opportunity to one company? Just have a friendly tax and regulatory and kind of cultural climate that will appeal to all comers, and then you don't have to go do a special tax or cash giveaway to a billionaire. But these stadium, the football stadium deals, they're always sold the same way. And again, if we don't explain how markets work, we're going to have a hell of a time explaining unintended consequences.
But look at the argument you just made. This is an equal protection argument. Yes. This is equality. Yeah. That is, why would you treat some people different from others? We should all be treated the same. And so we're not going to tax the businesses already in North Carolina and use that money to reduce the taxes of Amazon if they come up. No, we are required to have equal protection for all. So we can actually take the moral high ground and still make that argument, because markets are actually consistent with equality before the law. You cannot discriminate.
And so that's my argument as we get to the conclusion. I said earlier I wanted to come back to the local level. Here in Southern California, there was a huge controversy with Disney in the city of Anaheim, California, around hotel subsidies being given to basically support Disney building some new hotels. They would give them sweetheart deals on parking structures and all these things. And the right were the big supporters of it, because they said, we want to support free markets. We want to support jobs. We want to support economic growth. And I said, the hell you do. You are favoring a rich, entrenched, powerful entity who is only in this position because they have the lobbyists necessary to even package this as a good thing. And you're not offering it to the Motel 6 operator down the street or to the young up-and-comer entrepreneur. Is there any principal difference at the local level versus the federal level in the theory you just shared, that do it as an equal opportunity under the law? Whatever tax scenario you're presenting to Disney, present it to Disney as long as you're presenting it to everyone else. Is that the rule of thumb that should judge local governance as much as federal?
In a way, it's even more important for local, because the differences that we can draw at the local level can be much sharper.
Yeah.
So the zoning requirements, the necessity of getting permits, all of these things are hyper local. Yeah. And generally, if you are a developer and you have a lot of political power, you can build new housing, you can build new businesses. If you're just an entrepreneur, and you think, I'm going to build some more houses because we need more houses, there's no way you can be able to do it. So I had a piece recently titled, All Housing is Affordable Housing. And what we need to do is have equal protection before the law instead of this hyper-local discrimination that's based on political power. If we just make it legal to build more houses and more hotels, Motel 6 can say, we own this block, we should be able to build a hotel on it. Well, yeah, but the neighbors, which are also hotels, say, I don't think so. We don't need any more hotels. Well, it's not up to them. That's not the way capitalism works. You don't go to the competitors and say, do you think we need this new increase in this product? They're going to say, no, I can make enough. And so that kind of discrimination is even worse at the local level. Some of the problem is zoning, but some of it is this sense of democratic, small d, democratic participation, which actually creates a hyper-crony local system. And I think the Disney example is a terrific one. Many of us, people on our side, my voice rises with indignation, people on our side have confused markets with business.
Yes.
We're not in favor of big business. No. We're in favor of markets. And if you get big by providing good services and value and earning profits and employing a lot of people, great. If you get big by political power, you suck.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's not just that you suck. I argue you're violating not only the social contract, there's a morality issue.
But I guess that's the reason. What I meant was not you inherently suck by getting big. If you exploit the political power.
I understand exactly what you mean. Agree with you completely. But see, I also take double offense, because I think the economic actor is a noble actor. and the competitive edge, the savvy, the skill that goes into providing a good or a service in an economy that is well received, the marketing, distribution, production challenges. I believe those people should be admired. And when they parlay their skill in those things and their success into rent seeking and cronyism, I think they deserve double dishonor.
But it's so tempting. Sure. You can make more profits that way.
Yep. Look, this is a topic near and dear to our heart at Capitol Record. I could literally sit here and talk to you all day about it. I cannot thank you enough for your contribution to the subject. I'm going to put your article in our show notes, and we would really love to have you back on Capitol Record, continue this this discussion, and really advancing the cause of a market-oriented ideology that is rooted in true competitive innovation and not relying on cronyist partnership with the state.
It was a pleasure. I look forward to talking again.
Thanks so much, Michael. Well, I hope you enjoyed that discussion as much as I did. I think there's a lot more that can be said. I really do encourage you to read The Road to Crony Capitalism. The link is in the show notes to this piece. But I think that Michael Munger is really doing some fantastic work in intellectually reinforcing the dangers of cronyism, intellectually challenging market advocates to be better, to do better, to stand tall against rent seeking. And I hope you've learned a bit in our discussion today on what it is, where it comes from, and what we need to do to fight the good fight going forward. He talks in his article about Hayek and his incredible contribution to us avoiding the road to serfdom. In so many ways, we find ourselves on a road to cronyism, and it's an equally perilous path. Let's do better in our cause for free and virtuous society. Thank you for listening to Capitol Record.